The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? I am your host, Soraya, as always. And tonight we have the second part of an interview with Edmund Marriage. And in this one, we discuss some things that people had issues with on the first interview, and then we get into talking about the real Garden of Eden and Druidic knowledge and the Anunnaki, or Anunnagi, depending on how you want to translate it. So, yes, with no further ado, here's Edmund Marriage. So, Edmund, welcome back to the show.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Now, last time I had you on, I do have a couple of questions from comments that people had left. Someone questioned your etymology of words in our previous interview. They didn't really specify, but maybe it was for the word Anunnaki. Could you tell people where the etymology you're using comes from?
The etymology comes from very detailed studies of the origins of cuneiform by Christian O'Brien. He knew that if he was going to be able to recover this past knowledge, he had to understand what the cuneiform was in terms of a writing and how it started. And he went right back to the original picture language, of which there are about 400 signs. And these are displayed very, very clearly within the Genius of the Few and the Shining Ones in the section on the Phaistos discs, which is the very earliest Indo-European picture signs. So for a head, you have a head drawn. To speak, you have the head and open its mouth. To drink, you put the water sign, a sort of ripple underneath the mouth, that means to drink. And then he looked at the evolution of the cuneiform from that original picture language, which was identified by the Reverend Professor George Barton at Bryn Mawr College around about 1900, who recognized that there were about between 400 and 500 picture signs, which was the simple spatial language, if you like, given to the ordinary people, quite distinct from the Eliphag, which was the speedy writing of Enoch. That was used in-house by the administrators, but the ordinary people had a simple picture language. But the simple picture language got taken over by the scribes and changed in its form. The head was turned on its side, and then straight lines were used in the cuneiform, which is a reed cutting into clay. And thank God they did that, because when they fired those clay tablets, they've lived forever. And when the Nippur Library was excavated by the University of Pennsylvania under Professor Hayes in 1896 to 98, then they managed to recover the history books from the very earliest Sumerian civilization at Uruk in particular, and they found that the Sumerians had written the whole story of their history of the founding of the Garden of Eden and their real live gods, who were people. And this is where we come back to the concept of the Elohim being the bright ones or shining ones in the planted highlands. And we also get back to the Anunnaki, which are the sons of An, many sons of An. And of course, sons really means descendants. So when we're talking about the difference between Anunnaki, and which is the O'Brien translation, and the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki is something that the some of the early scholars perhaps interpreted or did interpret, and Sitchin picked that up. But O'Brien did the thorough job working from the beginning and realized that it should be pronounced not Anunnaki, but Anunnaki. The difficulty with the academics is that they weren't taught to go back to the original picture language. And I have big disagreements with current linguists who've all learnt their ancient languages from books, which have been written inaccurately because people did not go back to the origins of cuneiform, which literally go back 5,000 BC, 6,000 BC.
Okay, all right. And so if people want to see this more visually, does The Shining Ones the place to go for that?
The Shining Ones is the key book to go to at the moment. The main reason is that The Genius of the Few is sold out. There will be another print run as soon as we can do it. But what I just wanted to say on that point, we've got eBay quoting £950 for A Genius of the Few, and I saw 3,600 on Amazon for second-hand Genius of the Few. This is outrageous, racketeering, profiteering nonsense, which shouldn't be allowed by eBay or Amazon. And people can buy the Shining Ones for £49.50, which includes postage. And in there, they get the equivalent of four or five books of concentrated, accurate historical knowledge. So please don't let people go out and pay ridiculous prices. Everything in The Genius of the Few is within The Shining Ones. We will be reprinting The Shining Ones soon as well. As I say, it's a warning to everybody that the racketeering around these books has been a nightmare for many years, in fact. And you'll see prices for second-hand copies of The Genius of the Few at £120. It's always been ridiculous, and I hope people won't fall into that trap. I sell these books through the Patrick Foundation, which is a non-profit-making organization. If we make any profits, we're going to put that money into very good causes. And so that's where I am, and that's where we are on those. And please buy The Shining Ones rather than The Genius of the Few if you can't get it.
Okay. All right. And that's not uncommon. A lot of, you know, hard-to-find or out-of-print books get just – the prices are outrageous when you look on Amazon or eBay and places like that.
Yes, I noticed, yeah.
And even some that are in print, like David Paulides' Missing 411 books, he only sells them on his website, but on Amazon they run for like five or six times the price he sells them on the website.
I can't understand why this is allowed. I've always had a problem with Amazon in that they've never ever told their customers who the publisher is and where they can get the books direct. I do not sell to Amazon. I do not want to have my customers paying an extra £7 or £8 for the privilege of doing business with Amazon.
Yeah. All right. Well, last time we also spoke a little bit of Jesus, and someone was questioning whether or not you felt that Jesus was divine.
We have to look at this question of what divine means. It stems from the original people who were later described as gods. It's mixed up in this concept of the transmigration of the soul, which the ancients believed in. The question of divinity, in my opinion, is that every single human being and life form is divine. It's connected, or should be connected, to the intelligent and responsive universe and to the creator of that universe, because we can't think of a better way of describing such a complex and fantastic system throughout not only our solar system, but the galaxy and the whole universe in which we live. Everything is connected. It's connected electrically. And so the word divine is bandied around. Now, the monarchs always were considered to be divine because they were appointed by the Anunnaki from the council, meeting place of the council of the Anunnaki, a divine council, they called it, at Karsag. And so that's where that tradition has come down. But it's as so many things, it's this misunderstanding of words and meanings over time.
Mm. Okay, all right. And you had said you wanted to make a correction about the star shafts in the Great Pyramid.
Yes, I wrote to you because we have this cycle of precession, which is 27,000 years. So we get a wobble, which has to be allowed for in identifying where the North Star was at any specific time. And I mentioned that you mentioned Orion,
right.
And we're talking about the star which is looking at the plan of Orion on the left was the North Pole Star at the time the Great Pyramid was built, and at the time of the Great Catastrophe at 12,850.
So you think that
today the North Star is Polaris. The North Pole Star then was Alpha Draconis. So it's this complicated business of the movement of the Earth in relation to the stars in the sky, and this is all related to precession, and so it's changing over time. So, but we now got computer models, so we can track where they've all come from and where they're all going.
And you said that it was. Do you think the pyramid was built 3,500 BC?
I don't think there's any doubt that the Great Pyramid was built 2,500 BC, and the reason for that was that we find 100 attempts at building pyramids on the Giza Plateau. The Abu Rawash Pyramid was even more sophisticated, more beautiful than the Great Pyramid, but it was plundered for building materials for Cairo, and it had a great deal of space inside for people. And the point I made about the pyramids, or have made about the pyramids, is that there was a fear that the Earth would be literally wiped out again by cometary debris. They'd had forecasted this around about 2,500, 2,600, and it happened at 2,354. This is when we saw the destruction of the city-state system across Mesopotamia, with cometary debris causing massive disruption right the way across the area, right to China as well. And this caused major changes in climate, etc. And we had a massive loss of population and life at that particular point in time. So they'd seen it coming. Stonehenge and the British henges were built as observatories, and many of them were converted into chambers which people could take protection in. Very important point. And so the Great Pyramid was clearly the principal building for storing important records, which they did not want to be lost should we have another catastrophe similar to the one in 12,850. There's no reason why people should go to so much enormous trouble building a structure which was perfectly designed to protect what was inside and underneath. They wouldn't have gone to that trouble just to bury people. That is a complete nonsense. It had to be a really important national emergency building project, which everybody was involved in, where everybody could go and take shelter in some form or another. You see this in the mastabas around the Great Pyramid. If you look at the so-called burial shaft, you find that was a water system. So they could stay in there for weeks and get the water supply to survive with. Very important feature in any kind of structure for surviving cometary debris, cometary catastrophe. You have to have that water supply. If you've got the water supply, fresh water supply, you live. If you don't, you die. And this is the same situation today. If we have another bout of cometary debris coming in, we've got to have those big tanks of fresh water in our basements.
Now, there's not an enormous amount of room in the Great Pyramid. Why wouldn't they have made more room? Was it just because of the way it had to be built?
If you look at the northern area of the Great Pyramid, you have a massive basalt platform. We haven't been allowed to look or excavate underneath that platform. There are many, many rooms or areas which people believe are down there, which would have stored enormous quantities of food and people as well. It's important, if we go to Abydos, we look at the structures there. They weren't tombs, they were shelters for people to go into and have food and be able to survive cometary debris. So we need a more detailed investigation of the Great Pyramid. Remember the boat, all these pyramids had boats attached. The Great Pyramid boat, two boats, but a boat that we can go and look at in the museum, I think it's in Cairo. When they dated the cedar wood, it was dated to 3,500 BC. So it had been around a long while. And Abu Rawash had room for two boats. So they built 150-foot long ocean-going boat, believe it or not, alongside the pyramid, because that would have been able to people to get around by boat if we'd had the kind of deluge or movements of water which we had at 10,850.
Okay, all right. So let's go into the Garden of Eden. Now, what was the Garden of Eden?
The Garden of Eden was a dry lake bed. It could have been drained, and we find people farming in that dry lake bed, which is in the Rashaya Basin. Some people call it the Ahia Basin, which is between the town of Rashaya and a village called Ka'uf. And it's overlooked by Mount Hermon. Now the key point about that is that the is a south-facing slope from Ka'uf down to the bed of this lake. Very, very fertile soil. A south-facing slope was crucial. There is abundant water from the cast limestone running off the tops of the anti-Lebanon mountains, running north from Mount Hermon, which, and those mountains are covered in snow for 6 months of the year today, and they would have been then, according to the archaeobiologists. So we had an adequate supply of snow melt water for the first 6 months of the year, and that snow melt water was crucial for growing crops in what was an area of 1,300 acres. Now, what we've done with our site survey has looked at the wells. Three wells still exist in the basin. There is remains of a great watercourse, very clear on the Google images. And so the watercourse was built to divert the floodwater away from the basin so it could be farmed. And this is where we get the story of the river went out of Eden and was parted into four rivers. The language, again, was a confusion over the meaning of the cuneiform signs, which actually said the great watercourse went out of Eden to where it was parted into four heads, which were irrigation channels, not other rivers. You don't get four rivers going out of somewhere. You get four rivers going into somewhere. And so it's just a simple misunderstanding of the cuneiform from which all the Bible material originally came from. And before that, it came from this simple picture language. So in all the many stages of changes and translations, we have got the basic message within the Bible, but it needs to be gone through with a fine-tooth comb and corrected, which is exactly what O'Brien did. If you look at the Golden Age Project website and look at alternative Genesis, you'll find out exactly how O'Brien deals with the entomology and the translation of so many of the important words, like Hashemim, which doesn't mean heaven, it means the planted highlands. And the word Elohim means the bright ones or shining ones. So we get not God in heaven, but the bright ones and shining ones in the planted highlands. It's basic common sense.
Okay. Now, was Eden established after the disaster at 12,000 years ago?
After the disaster at 12,850, we went into what is called the Great Younger Dryas Ice Age. And that lasted till about 9,500, 9,600. And then all of a sudden, the temperatures picked up very rapidly. Now, there are reasons for this within the various cycles of climate change, which are dealt with very well by Hans Fenmark and Nigel Calder in The Chilling Stars, which is the must-read book for anybody who wants to work out what causes climate change. And so we know that we tend to go very quickly into cold periods, even without catastrophes, and we also tend to go into very warm periods in a relatively short space of time. In fact, in terms of cold periods, ice ages, that's happened within literally years, 10 years. It may be quicker if it's a cometary debris problem. When things get warmer, then the planet, and we've got all the temperature records, so we can see how hostile the temperature swings were up to that point of 9,600. So at 9,600, the survivors who managed to survive that awful catastrophe were able to start again in this Rishaya Basin area. 1,300 acres, incredibly complex farming. There are 15 basic requirements that have to be dealt with before you can grow a crop or prepare the ground, grow the crop, harvest it, store it, deal with the actual individual seeds, supervise it, prevent it being damaged by wild animals. It goes, list goes on and on. And the domesticated crops were totally different to the wild crops. And therefore, they had to be genetically modified to incredibly high standards, standards that we can't really even get to today. This is so difficult for people to understand. They've all learnt the Bible by heart. They think the Bible is gospel truth, but they need to open their minds to see that it needs a different, up-to-date, knowledge-based appraisal of a message that was being conveyed. And if people begin to look at what O'Brien has done, then it'll all fall into place. I had somebody last week saying, had bought The Genius of Theo on eBay, said it was the best book he's ever bought. It's fantastic, which it is. It suddenly opens your mind and broadens your mind about what our history is all about and what a mess and a muddle we've all made over 3,000 or 4,000 years of the message left to us by our brilliant and very advanced ancestors.
Okay. All right. So they established this garden after things calmed down a little bit.
Yes. Things became very sudden. All of a sudden, we had a tremendous stability in terms of climate and temperature. That allowed them to start again. So it was a restart of agriculture. They wouldn't have been able to farm anywhere much on this planet for the previous 30,000 years because of the hostility of the climatic environment due to cometary, a massive supernova explosion, which led to this spraying the Earth with a bright flash and shock waves, and then much later on, in 10,850, the last remnants of the debris which blasted through our solar system.
So this took 30,000 years for all this debris?
Yes, because the climate change, the climate was, the temperature was swinging so wildly. It may have been possible in certain parts of the planet, like the Azores, for example, where the coral records show that was quite a degree of stability in terms of sea temperatures as a result of the Gulf Stream coming up from the south. And it may have been possible for certain areas on the planet like that for people to actually farm. But that's another separate subject.
Okay.
But we know that we had our brilliant ancestors managed to survive. They had a cache of seeds, so maybe they brought the seeds with them. And the seeds had already been produced as domesticated crops. But the key point about that area of Mount Hermon was it was one of the very few glacial refuges for all the wild grasses. 95% of the wild grasses, the oak, the pistachio, the olive, many of the basic crops. And there was a lot of wild animals had survived too in that area. It was a glacial refuge, as it was called, for plants and wildlife. And so it was a perfect place to start again.
Okay. Now, where did the story of Adam and Eve come from?
Well, we have the story of Cain and Abel and Adam and Eve. And they're very sort of, they're very ingrained in the human psyche. You know, you've got the first man and the first woman. But actually, when you look into it closely, Adam and Eve were in the garden of the gods, and they were speaking to a serpent, and a serpent isn't a snake at all, never was a snake. And this is one of the great mistakes of people thinking serpents were bad. A serpent actually meant a wise man or a wise woman. Oh. And the archangels were the two-eyed serpents, and two-eyed because they could see more than other people. And the angels were the one-eyed serpents, and the third order of craftsmen were the watchers, again, eyes. You have the many-seeing face, the four-headed statue of somebody looking in four different directions at the same time, which is about the all-seeing person. And what you see also makes a great deal of difference to what you know and understand. And so that's the word serpent, the roots of serpent come in to serve many of the survey, many of the basic functions of wise people.
Okay, and who were Adam and Eve?
The nearest we get to Adam and Eve, they were the children of the first generation of the children of the gods. And the gods were An, Enlil, Enki, and the lady was called Ninkasag. And Ninkasag and Enki ran the laboratory where they developed the seeds and also produced, by in vitro fertilization, produced a generation of people. Simply in order to provide workers and provide the kind of skills that they needed at that time. Now, in vitro fertilization is something we understand today. It's going on all the time, certainly with people and in particular across the world with animals. The question mark about Adam and Eve is really, O'Brien deals with it much better than I can describe it in the books, and it we have a story here which was pretty well mangled by the church, who wanted to produce their own version of events. So they thought up the one God instead of plural gods. And they thought it would be great to be able to show that Eve was sinful, and therefore they could introduce something called original sin. We were all born sinful, but if you come to us and ask to have your sins forgiven and pay us money, then we'll forgive your sins. So when we're dealing with Adam and Eve and original sin and the denigration of women, we're looking at something bad that happened, which was imposed upon us by religion. And I mean that quite seriously. We have to review the situation. I had a long conversation with some Baptists last week about the issue of original sin. O'Brien deals with this because he shows from the books of Enoch that the angels weren't judging people in the context of whether they were good or bad or sinful. They were simply looking at people and making assessments of how they could get the best out of them. Very, very different from saying you're all sinful. And this is described very, very clearly within the books of Enoch and in on the website and in, as I say, the O'Brien books, and I deal with it too in Learning from History, Part 1, 2, and 3. So it's up to people to look at the new evidence we've got. We can't blame people. Everybody wants to read a book and believe it. Everybody wanted to read the Bible and believe it literally. But we have to, in the light of modern knowledge, modern communications, modern enlightenment, we have to look at these areas of knowledge, which we have been maybe taught to learn parrot fashion. We should learn to have another look and realize that we shouldn't ignore it. We should understand how it evolved and how we can get back on the right path. Where did the road go? We need to get back on the road.
Now, from what you just described, too, doesn't sound a world different from Zechariah Sitchin's interpretation. It's just that you're not dealing with aliens.
Correct.
So, because it's still, you know, that they actually created a worker class and information like that, but he just puts it all in a ancient alien sort of spotlight, which you don't do at all.
No, because one time I was employing 50 people. I've gone through the hardcore business of knowing that if you treat your workers well, educate them, look after them, and what you actually do is bring out the best in them, and then you succeed. If you enslave your workers and enslave the political classes are still wanting to enslave us. We've got the European Union trying to enslave us. We've had socialism throughout Britain trying to enslave us, and it doesn't work. You have to bring out the best in people. You have to do exactly what Jesus and Confucius said, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So if you haven't employed people, if you haven't been involved in business, if you haven't been a people manager as such, then you pick up these crazy stories about slavery and slaves, etc., which is endless and totally misleading and just one thing that one slave happened to have a problem with, or one slave over happened to be a problem with, blackens the whole story. And then it's regurgitated by Sitchin as the gods started it. And of course, it's not true. The gods were totally benevolent. They left us a brilliant system of social organization. And the sooner we look at that and realize that, the better. And also recognize that your constitution, the English constitution on which your constitution was based, is a system of government which is closest to the one left to us by the Anunnaki within the city-states. Hmm. And that's something I can come on to later, because it's the whole essence of where we are today in understanding how we can enact good government for the people. Equal rights under the law, equality of women, the truth before the world.
All right, well, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Edmund Marriage.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we're talking tonight with Edmund Marriage. This is part two of our series of interviews. And do you want to get into a little of what the Anunnaki taught?
Oh, sorry, what the Anunnaki taught?
Yeah, do you want to get into a little bit about what the Anunnaki taught about city-states and
yes,
society and such?
Certainly. The best way I can describe it is how a city-state functioned. In the first instance, every city-state, like every village, every town, every company, you have to try and find the best man and woman for the job, because it was a question of men and women in those days. It was Yahweh and Asherah of whatever town or whatever small town or even a village throughout the whole of the Middle East region. That was what it called, Yahweh and Asher, which meant the leader and his consort or wife. Now, within the early city-states, which were big towns, some of them 50,000, 60,000 people, you had to have a man who had had 20 years training at least, had been selected amongst not the elite, but the more, if you like, intelligent craftsmen, and would have been chosen to be the best man for the job. We still had that system under King Alfred in England in about 1880. The king was selected as the best man for the job. The city-state system, he was surrounded by the senior qualified druids, is the word. Druidism was the original system of doing things, which lasted very much until the time of the Romans when they arrived. William Blake, many other people have identified the fact that Druidism went right back to the original Garden of Eden, and I deal with that in Learning from History Part 2. So the king had the very best people under him in all the various departments. Now, great cities like Mari on the Euphrates and Uruk, you would have found something like 200 craft trades and guilds in every one of the important trades that makes a city tick. And children had that knowledge passed to them by their father and their mother in all the various trades. Women had very specific roles in education, medicine, administration, etc. And then you had the civil servants as such, further down the list, who were the, if you like, the administrators who acted on behalf of the king at the top, the Druid advisors. Now, the point about that system was there was no religious divisions to distract people and no political divisions to distract people. It was a very clear message about the survival of the whole community. So it was the king's job to deliver freedom, justice, leisure and instruction. And it was up to the individuals through the pursuit of excellence in their own departments to be able to compete in terms of doing a really good job of what they had decided or were allocated to do. And that was incredibly successful. And that's how the city-state system worked. Way before Greece, invented the word democracy. And you probably, historians will remember that Plato said that democracy always leads to debt, bankruptcy, and chaos. This is exactly what we're seeing today all around the world because we haven't learned those lessons. Very, very important point. And your marvelous Mark Twain also made a very accurate observation. However you like, whether you like it or not, he said 10% of the people think, 10% think they think, and 80% would die rather than think. That is as true today as ever, especially now we've got so much television and media, particularly Facebook and Twitter, where people get involved in trivia and, in their own little way, waving spears at each other. It's disruptive. It can be constructive, yes, but if only we could get more people to think. Now, in a democracy, you've got a situation where the majority view is held, and unfortunately, the majority view is nearly always wrong. So we have to go back in government to trying to train and find the best people in all the specific crafts and trades in order to make the country run efficiently and smoothly. And that's where we are now. If we don't get back to that very quickly, then we're in real trouble. And what we're seeing in Britain now is a revival of the people, the people's voice. UKIP, the UK Independence Party, has just won, or just won a first seat in Parliament, and swung the vote in the UK to the extent that there is a very good possibility they will hold the balance of power next spring. That's never happened before. This is dramatic. This is a political party on behalf of the people as a whole, taking votes from all the established parties, both left and right, Labour and Conservative. And we have a revival of common sense and a realization that we do not want the European Union to run our country. The mistake that's been made by the politicians, and if you compare this with back to the city states again, what we've done in this country, we've had wonderful constitution like you. Our constitution divides the crown, the powers of the crown, which is the contract between the monarch and the people, and the powers of the crown are all the jobs of the civil servants, the police, everybody who works for the people. One power. The second power is the House of Lords, which is supposed not to be political, but to hold all the brightest and cleverest people in the country, especially when they reach retirement age. And the third group are the Commons. Now, in this country of ours, the Commons, over the last 200 years, have accumulated more powers. And in 1912, under Asquith, they remove the powers of the Crown and the Lords, and Edward Heath transferred all the powers that had already been transferred to the Commons. He managed to transfer all those powers to the EU, foreign nations where we don't even have a majority vote. So this is the kind of crazy world we live in, which is now coming to a halt, coming to a stop, thanks to the UK Independent Party. And we're going to see and hear a lot more about them in the next 2 or 3 years. And hopefully they will find the best people to advise them so that the people, all the people, every creed, every colour, every nationality, can be properly looked after and catered for, including all those people who want to come to Britain. And we should be flattered that so many people want to come here. And one of the things I've suggested is that we have a work and skills, a national work and skills service, so we don't have anybody who is unemployed. We need to be able to make sure that we can handle all the people who come to this country and make sure that they are all usefully employed and trained and happy. In the old days, under the Druids, anybody arriving in Britain was given either 3 or 5 acres of land to feed their family and free passage through the country. There was also a free health service. That's what we had 2000, 3000 BC. And there is so much here to be learnt from what we were left by the Anunnaki.
Now, how do we track the Druids back to the Anunnaki?
Well, you first of all start with the god An, and Anunnaki means the sons of the god An, who was the premier god, so to speak. An was the god of Abraham, which, of course, An is the supreme leader of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And An lived in the city of Ur, and the principal god Ur was dedicated to was An. So we got that link. Now, the Tuatha-De-Nann means the people of the god An. Mm. And the Druids always said, we are the successors of the Tuatha-De-Nann. And you can follow the trail, and the Druids in Ireland, right the way back to Lebanon, to the god An. And the tribe of Dan also come into this, as they were a key people in that area. The tribe of Dan were mainly seafarers from Tyre and Sidon. But we've got such an exciting history to tell the world if we begin to uncover the facts about our past and just how benevolent the gods were. They weren't aliens in the sense that Sitchin talks about. He was a journalist. He wasn't a farmer. He wasn't a politician. He was a journalist. He wanted to sell books, and he did it very successfully, and he provided excellent material, which he took from mostly from other people, a lot of what he took from other people was wrong. Samuel Noah Kramer gave him a great deal of valuable information about Sumer, I deal with this on the website. You can look at an article I did which compared the work of a Christian O'Brien with Sitchin. I've met Sitchin. I understand the way he thinks. He was very upset to think that somebody else was challenging his authority, which disappointed me because I gave him a copy of The Genius of the Few, and he said I was there first. But the point is that we all learn, and we all have to lose our egos if we can and try and search for the truth. And this was the Druid motto, was the truth before the world. And if we look at the world today, the big business is bearing false witness. And the laws of Moses, which come from the edicts of Anne and Enil, is quite clear that we should not bear false witness. But now that's become the biggest business in the world. And British police, for example, are only able to deal with 5% of fraud. Yet, wearing another hat, they tell us that they're reducing levels of crime.
Well, how do you think Sitchin got aliens out of the texts?
Well, the alien situation came from Sitchin confusing Nippur, which was the leading center dedicated to Enlil and Ninkasag in Sumer. Now, they dedicated their towns to these gods several thousand years later, and it was the Nippur library we found the Karsag tablets, which is the Sumerian historical record of the Garden of Eden. Great detail, which you can read on the books, on the website, and on the learning from history material. I think it's summary of that, really, that we can, if we do our homework and just do some simple reading, as most people who've come back to me after reading of Genius of the Few, suddenly it all becomes clear that, the truth is the most powerful weapon we have in changing things. If it's not the truth, then people will dismiss it. Sitchin's work was adapted and agreed by many people, which have led them off on all manner of wild goose chases. In particular, as I said, back to the Nippur point, the P and the B are interchangeable. So what Sitchin was doing in the translation was thinking that when the gods went to Nippur, which is a town, they were in fact going to Nibiru. Do you see how that mistake can be made? The other big problem was the dating. And there was a Cambridge professor who dated the Isin chronologies back for the Sumerian gods to 220,000 years. Well, anybody with common sense would scratch their heads at that to start with. And, of course, L.A. Waddell, who was the great historian, made the point that that was complete nonsense, and he actually had the Sumerian king lists translated and sorted out, which had the earliest Sumerian king at 3,360 or thereabouts, and that was a confederation of the city-states. And so when we hear people talking about gold mines in South Africa at 210,000 BC, and that the remains are still there, using the Sitchin material, when actually what we're looking at is homesteads, which are no more than 7,000 years old, then you can see how people get the wrong end of the stick. And when they're going to Nippur, and it's Nibiru, it's a planet, we can see it in the Sumerian literature and the drawings, it all becomes a complete nonsense. There is a legitimate case for saying that we had developed very sophisticated people on this planet, and from the technology that they were using, they may well have been able to travel and certainly get to our nearest neighbor, Mars. And that's a subject I'm dealing with tomorrow. We know that Mars had large seas at one point in time and has water now. And there is a strong feeling or body of evidence among the geologists and the experts, in particular Bernard Dallaire, who wrote Cataclysm with Derek Allen, that Mars lost its atmosphere at the same time as we lost a large chunk of our atmosphere at 10,850.
Okay. have about five different questions here. let's see. So how advanced do you think the Anunnaki could have been? So do you think they would have been more advanced than we were?
I think if they'd been able to record the cataclysm and the degree of axis shift and encode that in the Great Pyramid, if they'd been able to choose the site of Stonehenge, which was a critical site for the lining up of the equinoxes, all the other structures and buildings built over a period of time, like the Baalbek platform, you find all sorts of interesting features here. The white powdered gold, for example, which were the monatomic elements, which we're only just beginning to understand. They were able to produce pure gold that required a temperature of 5,000 degrees, and that was proven and backed by the Atomic Energy Commission at Harwell, by the head of that organization, in a letter to Charles Hapgood, who was your famous American scholar who realized that the ancients had accurately mapped the world thousands of years ago. Another issue. O'Brien deals with that. Livio Stacchini deals with that. So our ancestors had mapped the world precisely and accurately. They'd mapped the stars precisely and accurately. They'd recorded the axis shift accurately. We have the whole story of the angels being observing the stars. When we look at the Bible, look at the books of Enoch, look at the material that O'Brien used, we're being told, we're given all the messages about what these people were doing. One of the features I'm going to bring up tomorrow is Jericho, town of Jericho and the tower. And two guys from the Jerusalem University have shown very clearly that the tower, Jericho, built between 9,000 and 9,600 BC, was used for astronomical observations. In other words, so you could tell where you were, you know. And this is very, very important material from the ancient records. And they were able to produce seeds, domesticated seeds and domesticated animals. And the technology there is amazing. Very, very important. Now, they had lime plaster, for example, which is crucial for agriculture. And lime plaster is quite, lime is crucial for agriculture, and lime is super for lime plaster. And the lime plaster is still on the tower, 9,500. The lime plaster is still there. They needed lime to correct the soil acidity. They needed to have a system of crops which included nitrogen-fixing crops. So they make nearly half the crops they produced fixed nitrogen. You know, we're learning these lessons today. Phosphate and potash were two major components which had to be allowed for in order to get plants to grow. Jericho is particularly interesting, and it was some 670 feet below sea level. So it was a very warm climate there at this key point of 9,600. It was a good supply of salt, crucial for preserving meat, and also bitumen, and a fantastic spring, the Ain Sultan spring, which is still running the same level, a quantity of water as it did in 9,400 BC. And that's on the course where the Jordan River enters the Dead Sea. So the Levantine corridor from Jericho to Tel Aswad and Damascus, this is the area where we see a sudden explosion of farming and villages and very organized people, following on from very basic Natufian people. The lady who excavated Jericho said it was clearly newcomers arrived at that site and changed things from the very basic round huts to square houses, plastered floors and walls, and great sophistication. And so they'd come from somewhere. They could well have been hanging out at Göbekli Tepe, where we know there were very sophisticated people producing prefabricated roof supports, etc., and on the top of a hill, because it was warmer on the top of a hill, and they could see all the animals they were hunting. They weren't farming. And Göbekli Tepe was on the edge of the area of Anatolia, which took another 500 or 600 years to warm up after the when the planet began to warm up and 40% of the surface was covered in ice. You can visualize the ice gradually melting back and these glacial refuges becoming key places for people to live, and the farming methods had to be delivered, and they were taken around the world in the next 2,000 years, which now is becoming accepted because that's what the evidence tells us. We also find wheat and remains of wheat and barley in the Americas. We find maize being cultivated 7,500 BC east of Mount Hermon. So many of the crops we think are unique to the various parts of the world, we find nearly all of them started in this Levantine corridor at the Karsag site and Jericho, which was a major outpost of the Shining Ones at the time when they restarted civilization.
Okay. Do we know how far back the culture of the Anunnaki go?
We don't. We've got the written records. They take us back to 9,600. Beyond that, we've got the geology, and we've got a lot of scientific information. We have scientific reports to say that the Earth's climate was so hostile, it is unlikely that anybody was able to farm before the supernova explosion at 49,000 BC. The coral records in the area around the Azores would suggest that the sea was warm enough and the area farming there was well enough protected from a range of mountains for that to be considered as a possible site, which we're told by the Egyptians is where the Anunnaki came from. These are all exciting things to look for. It may well be that we've got Anunnaki in South America in the area of Lake Titicaca. We need more evidence. We certainly have evidence of 6, 7, 8, 12 feet of silt lying on top of a mountain almost at Lake Titicaca area. In other words, the whole of that coast has been lifted many, many thousands of feet very suddenly, which is what the geologists are now telling us happened at that 10,850 catastrophe boundary. I know that I've been told by geologists that there's an area off New Zealand where there were vertical movements in the Earth's crust of 50 miles at that particular time, 10,850. So a few thousand feet in Lake Titicaca would have been a small event. We also know that the Azores were connected to Africa at that point, and very large parts of Eastern Asia were covered by water. The Sahara, there was a big sea in the middle of it. So the whole of the surface of the Earth was very dramatically moved vertically at the point when the Earth was tipped on its axis.
Okay. What do you think the oldest site that we're aware of at the moment is?
The oldest town is without any doubt, Jericho. We've got clearly human habitation sites which are much older than that. I've been to Africa and seen, you know, little circles of stones where the hunter-gatherers would have put a thorn fence to protect themselves, but they always had a layer of stones at the bottom of the wall of every hut because they had to keep out wild animals. You've got a lot of very interesting occupation sites in the caves of Spain and France, and hence the cave paintings. Yeah. You've got the Sulatrine people who had the best flint, quality flint, and best flint knapping that anybody's ever achieved. And that was at 20,000 BC. And we find those quality flints and that technology in the Americas with the Clovis flints, which shows contact between the Silurian people of Spain and America between 20,000 and 12,000. We've also got this haplotype X, which is common in Asia and Europe, being picked up in the Americas at 30,000 BC. There is a lot of evidence of human occupation, but not anything any more sophisticated than Jericho. Jericho is very unique in great sophistication, suddenly arriving. People from outside coming there and choosing that place, and it was the best possible place they could have chosen to farm and to restart agriculture. So these people were clever enough to know where to go to choose the best place to start agriculture again. And we find, for example, the millet, what's called Italian millet, which was grown in that area, and we find it in China at 8,500 BC. So we got the shining ones taking the seeds and the technology around the world, all corners of the world, the seven so-called centers of agriculture, so-called independent centers of agriculture. It's very easy to link all those independent centers to the one center at Carsag and to realize that the technology was taken around the world and didn't suddenly arrive by accident at those seven points all at the same time.
All right. We're almost out of time for this week, but I have one more question for you. And that is, were the Anunnaki humans like us, or were they a different offshoot species?
All the indications are that they were Cro-Magnon, us. We know that everyone on the planet carries the same M158 marker on the male chromosome. So we, all of us on the planet, if you're an Aborigine or whoever you are, everybody on the planet can track their male side back to one man at 50,000 BC or thereabouts. The first two chromosomes are fused. We still don't know why, but that is something that can only be done from outside. In other words, genetic manipulation. My own view, and I think it's pretty broad, is that we are all one species, Homo sapiens sapiens, Cro-Magnon. There were a whole number of species, including Bosgut man, Neanderthal man, etc., on the record. But I'm quite clear in my mind that the shining ones simply were very tall because they came from a generations that had been living in a much denser atmosphere than the atmosphere of Earth after the axis shift. And we know we have the giant mammoths, saber-toothed tigers, giant sloths, a whole of the animal kingdom. We had very large animals. Now, when this is tested in a laboratory, putting fish in tanks and to increase the atmospheric pressure in those tanks, we find that fish grow to twice the size and live twice as long. It's a very interesting link. But if we were aliens, it would show up on the genetic research that's being done at the moment. And that may be proved to be true, that there is an outside element. I've been told, and other people listening can tell me if I'm right or wrong, because I always like to test hypotheses, and that is that our circadian rhythms for Homo sapiens sapiens, our circadian rhythms match that of Mars. In other words, we may have been populated from Mars, which is our nearest planet. With the kind of technology that the Anunnaki had, they could have got there quite easily. So that's just throwing a wild card in to test the water.
So do you think they just had a more advanced culture living next to a more primitive culture?
Well, I think if you look at today, we've got a very advanced culture and a very, very primitive culture living alongside each other. Yeah. And Chief Sitting Bull your greatest Indian leader, when he came to the East Coast of America to look at all that was going on, to visit the president, made a lovely quote. He said, "White man can make everything, but he can't distribute it." And that was before he was shot in the back. We aren't distributing good things to people. Just go and look at Sierra Leone today. Look around the world and look at the enormous gap between those who are well off and those who are not well off.
Yeah.
And look at the enormous gap between people who have basic common sense and thrive on their and live on their senses and their guts and their courage, against those who don't seem to have any common sense anymore. And we come right back to this question: how do we administer government? How do we get peace amongst nations? And how do we get this peacemaking role in place and find out why the ISIS jihadists are so angry? There may be very good reasons why they're so angry. At least we should try and find out why. We've got a fantastic Muslim community in Britain. They're very much part of the UKIP vote, I think. And so we ought to be able to look upon each other, wherever we are on the planet, as brothers and sisters, and care for each other. And back to the Confucius and Jesus message of do unto others as we'd have to do unto you.
Yeah.
And that's the same for people, companies, and governments. We've seen an extraordinary situation in Europe with the EU winding up the Ukraine and upsetting Vladimir Putin. I'm really quite a fan of Vladimir Putin. He's managed to get Russia out of one hell of a muddle, and the Russians have suffered enough in the last 100 years. We should be working beside them, not trying to take land away from them or upset all the Russian-speaking people in eastern Ukraine. They need a vote. They need to be able to have the right to choose where they are, like the Falkland Islanders. The Falkland Islanders have the right to choose who lives and who governs the Falkland Islanders. It's down to the people again and the people's vote. It's not for politicians to tell people where to go and what to do. And that's the big lesson I think we've got to get across to everybody in the world. It's the people, and we have to act in a peaceful way, and we have to understand everybody and accommodate everybody, even if that might be painful for a time. And so back to the Druid motto of the truth before the world.
All right, where can people find you online?
They can find me at, I haven't had to change the website much, and I am going to give it a major update in the next 2 years, but it's called thegoldenageproject.org.uk.
Okay, and your online lectures can be found linked off of there?
Just put my name, Edmund Marriage, into YouTube, and you'll find a lot of material there. They're long. There's a lot of stuff. There's 130 slides. I hope there's 130 facts on each of the slides. There will be 14 of them soon. And just take your time with them.
And they're called Learning from History.
Yeah, Learning from History.
All right. Well, I thank you, Edmund. We'll have you back before the end of the year for part 3.
Soraya, thank you very much. I really enjoyed coming on your show, and I wish the show the very best of the luck. And let's hope we can find out where the road did go.
Thank you so much, Edmund. We're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world?
Can you hear the bird?
to be wary. You are getting to the heart of the universe. Venture cousin Tatriot, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting.